So tonight is kind of an odd topic, inner boundaries. And I'll say that I really, this week, more than usual, I kind of struggled with the talk in the sense that there were themes that I wanted to talk about, but I couldn't figure out for the life of me what is the topic? What how do these things fit together, you know? And it kind of crystallized over the weekend. So I'll begin by saying that at sunset tonight, Samhain ended. Samhain is a Celtic holiday. And to explain this, I'll just say that in the Celtic understanding, the year is a great circle, and there's, you might say, a light half or a yang half and a dark half or a yin half. And at the top and the bottom and the two crossover points, there are significant days on the cycle of the year. Samhain is the crossover point from light to dark. It's when we cross into the dark time of the year, according to the Celtic imagination. And the other crossover point is Beltane, May Day, when we're crossing from darkness into light. And it said that the veil between the two worlds is thin at these two crossover points. The veil between our human, rational, everything makes sense kind of world, and the world, you could say, of the fairies, the wee people, the world of magic and dance and play and mischief and imagination, and a kind of playful vitality that doesn't necessarily always exist in our human world. This is also in the Christian understanding. Today is a holiday known as All Saints' Day. So I'll give you at least the Catholic understanding. Today is All Saints' Day. Tomorrow is All Souls' Day. What's the difference? All Saints' Day, according to the Catholic understanding, saints are people who are in heaven. And so they're all the named saints, you know, Saint Francis and Saint Patrick, the famous people. But the understanding has always been that there's been nameless good people. They never got famous, but they were good people and they went to heaven anyway, you know. And so that day honors everyone in heaven, and in a way it is asking them to pray for us because they're in the presence of God, so they can pray for us. All Souls Day is for everyone in purgatory. So those are the people who die, who maybe, you know, basically good people, but had their flaws, you know, and so they're working off their sins in purgatory. Eventually they will get into heaven, but they're in a place of suffering at the moment. And so All Souls Day is designed for us to pray for them. This corresponds, incidentally, to Dia de los Muertos in the Latino tradition. Of course, in the Catholic understanding, you can wind up in heaven, purgatory, or hell, and there's no day for hell because those people are considered beyond hope in the Catholic understanding. And apparently, these 2 days, the All Saints' Day and Samhain, there was a profound dynamic between them, and each one influenced where the other would be on the calendar to some extent. This played out over centuries in Celtic Christianity. So what interests me about all this is in the Upanishads, 3,000 years ago, they already had the insight that all gods, all heavens, all demons, all hells, all correspond to states of mind, states of consciousness, you know. And this is not to affirm or deny the existence of heaven or hell or anything like that. It's not my point here, but more to look at them in terms of archetypal psychology. What are these places within us? And on reflection, I think it's pretty clear that our ordinary ego state of mind, that has a lot in common with purgatory. You know, like basically, we're good people, we're trying to make it work, but we're suffering. You know, we really have the best intentions. We hope we get it together someday, you know, but life is a struggle, that sort of thing. I think there is a way that something like heaven exists within us, a kind of timeless calm, timeless joy, a place of boundless love. I think there's ways that we can, as it were, touch that place, you know, with tremendous practice. And then there's hell. And I think we all know the places in us that feel like hell, you know. Often the places of tremendous pain, often the places that we condemn. I don't want to feel that, you know, that sort of thing. And it's interesting, the Christian idea of hell, the very conventional idea is that you get one chance in this life and then you go to heaven or you go to hell, basically. Like one chance and it's done. And in the Buddhist understanding, if some of you may be familiar with the Buddhist world wheel with the six realms of existence, and one of them is a hell realm. In all six realms, the Buddha appears. In other words, there's always the possibility of healing. There's always the possibility of consciousness. It's not particularly auspicious if you're in hell and suffering. You're probably not going to take up Buddhist practice there. You know, it's often said in the Buddhist scriptures how much our human existence is so much more suited to Buddhist practice than any of the other realms. But nonetheless, no place is beyond healing or beyond grace in that view. And the Celtic realm, the realm of the wee people, that's a very uncontrollable part, you know, a place where imagination and inspiration comes from, a place where dream comes from, a place in us that understands deep flow in a way that the mind doesn't, you know. It's a place that we can't control. And because we can't control, a lot of times it gets assigned to our inner hell, you know. And so this word control and self-control, this was one of the things that was interesting me in relation to all this. How to say it? I think it's undeniable that part of growing up, part of maturing, part of spiritual growth is gaining more control. I think all of us who have any kind of mileage, it's very easy for us to remember times in our life, in our teenage years, in our 20s, when we didn't have as much control and we made a mess of things in various ways. You know, we blurted out the awkward thing or impulsively did the awkward thing. You know, now that we have a little more control, maybe I think that thing, but I don't blurt it out, you know, this sort of thing. And so it's undeniable that part of growth is control. But I think it is a blind spot of this culture to think that all of maturity, all of growth, is about control. Because there's that whole other side of growth and maturity that is about letting go, surrendering, allowing, letting be. And I think we live in a society that overvalues control and undervalues surrender. And of course, that leads in many cases beyond healthy self-control to neurotic over-control. And it's subtle. You know, healthy self-control, I would say, is what leaves us feeling freer, what leaves us feeling more spacious, more at ease, with more possibility. Where neurotic over-control, it may constrain us, it may make us feel more lifeless, it may make us feel numb. I think we also live in a time where being numb in a way is kind of valorized, like, you know, numb is almost praised as, oh, well, that person has stoic strength, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas really all spiritual practices, as I understand them, are about allowing us to feel things more deeply and allowing us to taste life more fully. Need a drink. And so this is connected to the whole issue of boundaries. And first of all, I think it's a little easier to think of boundaries at first in terms of interpersonal boundaries. Obviously, if I'm in a relationship where, you know, I have very poor boundaries and somebody else is, you know, I'm letting them, you know, run over me, or I'm denying my own needs or that sort of thing. You know, it's a very crude boundary to say, you know, I want nothing to do with you. Never going to talk to you. I don't want to think about you. I don't want to be in the same room as you. You know, that sort of thing. That you might say is a very crude boundary. Sometimes it's necessary. You know, there's a world of difference between saying, you know, I can never deal with you again versus saying, you know, I need a little time right now and then I can return to the conversation. You know, I think it is always, I think it is one of the hallmarks of a healthier boundary that at least we're ready for the conversation. You know, we may totally disagree with the person, we may not like what we hear, but at least we're open to having the conversation. And I'll just say on this issue of, you know, when things are intolerable, you know, it's funny. Of course, sometimes when something's intolerable, it's just a sense experience. You know, something is, you know, a noise is too loud or, you know, a horrible smell or something like that. I'm not so much concerned about that, but the intolerable, something that is emotionally intolerable, something that is morally or intellectually intolerable to us. Often that external thing that feels intolerable, it corresponds to something within me that I haven't learned to tolerate yet, you know? And so if something's intolerable in here, then I'm not going to be able to tolerate it out there, that sort of thing. And so it raises the interesting question when we think about boundaries and the kinds of boundaries we have in the external world, what kind of boundaries do we have in the internal world? You know, Jung's insight that all these places, you know, our inner heaven, our inner hell, our inner land of the we people, you know, all of these places confront us with a kind of otherness, you know? And what sort of boundary do we create with this otherness, you know? Are we in a place of don't want to feel that, you know, can't deal with that, never going to deal with that, you know, kind of boundary? Or are we, as it were, are we open to the conversation? You know, and what would it mean to be in a conversation? You know, first of all, what would it mean to open a conversation with a place of tremendous pain within us? You know, often that begins by just a lot of listening before it can actually become a conversation. And what would it be to be in conversation with our inner wildness? You know, to be in conversation with the energies in us that are essentially uncontrollable. You know? And one of the archetypes that I think that speaks to this is the archetype of the hero and the wild man. And I've talked about this a little before in other Dharma talks, in the myth of Gilgamesh. That's one of the famous examples that Gilgamesh has this friend, the wild man Enkidu, and they have this powerful friendship. It also plays out in more modern terms in Star Wars, in the relationship of Han Solo and Chewbacca. You know, and it's a fascinating kind of image of what it is for the ego to relate to these powerful animal energies of the psyche. You know, Han Solo does not control Chewbacca. They have a relationship. There's a dialogue there. And often Han Solo is the one who points out, you know, sets the lead and tells Chewbacca what, you know, what the better way to go is. But there's times that Chewbacca offers input and Han Solo has to agree that that's the better way. You know, in other words, there's a kind of back and forth there, you know. What would it mean to have that kind of relationship with ourselves? with the animal energies, the animal wildness within us. I would say ultimately, just as we're called to practice tremendous compassion and kindness toward all the people we meet in the external world, really all the wisdom traditions have that in one form or another, so we're called to practice tremendous kindness and compassion to all the internal others, you know. What would it mean to have, as it were, a banquet of love in the heart, where every part of us, every broken or wounded part of us, could come to the banquet, you know? So I think I'll share the quote sheet. I always have a quote sheet. Oh, I shared the physical copy and... There's the copy for the Zoom folks. And drop the link in the chat.
Thank you, Mike.
Inner boundaries. This wonderful one from Rumi. Be crumbled so wildflowers will come up to where you are. You've been stony for too many years. Try something different. Surrender. From Dryden. Happy the man and he alone who can call today his own. He who secure within can say, tomorrow do thy worst, for I have lived today. You know, just that profound affirmation of life, you know, being so alive today, I'm not concerned with that, what happens tomorrow. From Spinoza, give up the notion that you must be sure of what you are doing. Instead, surrender to what is real within you, for that alone is sure. Very deep. Walter Otto says, he who begets something which is alive must dive down into the primal depths in which the forces of life dwells. And when he rises to the surface, there is a gleam of madness in his eyes, because in those depths, death lives cheek by jowl with life. The primal mystery is itself mad. The matrix of duality and the unity of disunity. Probably Walter Otto actually would have been friends with Mr. Carl Jung, who's next. It is only when we realize that life is taking us nowhere that it begins to have meaning. The most intense conflicts, if overcome, can leave behind a sense of security and calm that is not easily disturbed. It is just these intense conflicts and their conflagrations which are needed to produce valuable and lasting results. Just some profound words on the healing process there. Ramana Maharshi says, grace is ever present. All that is necessary is that you surrender to it. From Helen Keller, truly remarkable woman, security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing at all. Psychologist Eric Fromm says, the task we must set for ourselves is not to feel secure, but to be able to tolerate insecurity. Anna East Nin says, quite simply, those who cannot live fully often become destroyers of life. Wow. The Jungian psychologist Marion Woodman said, having a body that is like a musical instrument, open enough to be able to resonate, literally resonate with what is coming both from inside and from the outside, so that one is able to surrender to the powers greater than oneself. Maya Angelou says, quite simply, be present in all things and thankful for all things. Ram Dass says, the heart surrenders everything to the moment. The mind judges and holds back. Pema Chodron says, Buddha taught that we're not actually in control, which is a pretty scary idea, but when you let things be as they are, you'll be much happier, more balanced, compassionate person. Jack Kornfield says, we are part of a vast plan of life unfolding. When individual loss strikes or there is a communal trauma, it is not a mistake. We have what it takes to endure it with courage. We can survive and go strong like the wild trees on the mountain ridges that have weathered the storms and become beautiful. With trust, we plant our seeds, tend them, and discover that although it isn't possible to control the world, we can always give care to the garden of our life. Sogyal Rinpoche says, we are fragmented into so many aspects. We don't know who we really are or what aspects of ourselves we should identify with or believe in. So many contradictory voices, dictates, and feelings fight for control over our inner lives, but we find ourselves scattered everywhere in all directions, leaving nobody at home. Meditation, then, is bringing the mind home. Sharon Salzberg says quite simply, no matter how much we want it to be otherwise, the truth is that we are not in control of the unfolding of our experiences. Tara Brock says, we can't understand the nature of reality unless we let go of controlling our experience. Alan Cohen says, it takes a lot of courage to release the familiar and seemingly secure to embrace the new, but there is no real security in what is no longer meaningful. There is more security in the adventurous and exciting, for in movement there is life, and in change there is power. Muji says quite simply, your urge to control life controls you. Yagi Vasudev says, the whole effort of spiritual process to break the boundaries you have drawn for yourself and experience the immensity of who you are. Steve Mariboli says, the reason so many people in our society are miserable, sick, and highly stressed is because of an unhealthy attachment to things they have no control over. Wow. Trent Shelton says, peace is something you'll never experience if you keep letting the things you can't control control you. Let it go. Reshma Menakin says, our virtues are wrapped inside of our limitations. It's only when we are in close proximity to others that we begin to intimately explore the boundaries of our virtues by slamming into our limitations. And finally, Mark and Angel Chernoff say, when you are no longer able to change your situation, you are challenged to change yourself, and that changes everything.